Welcome to Learning English, a daily 30-minute program from the Voice of America. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson. This program is aimed at English learners, so we speak a little slower and we use words and phrases, especially written, for people learning English.
Today on the program, you will hear from John Russell and Dan Novak. Later, we will present our American history series, The Making of a Nation. But first, countries in Eastern Europe are preparing for possibly hundreds of thousands of people fleeing Ukraine if the crisis with Russia worsens. Some Polish towns are already listing places available. And Romania is considering refugee camps. People are concerned that any unrest could affect their country's economies. There is also concern about a wave of migration not seen since the 1990s during the breakup of the former Yugoslavia. Russia has more than 100,000 troops along the border with Ukraine. The United States has warned that an attack could begin in the coming days. Russia denies any such plans and has accused the West of hysteria. Still, governments and towns near the Ukrainian border are getting ready to take in refugees if needed. The mayor of the eastern Polish town of Chekanów said it was ready to receive around 80 refugees in a hotel within 48 hours. Earlier this week, the northern town of Elbląg said it had 420 places available. The central Polish city of Toruń said it had 96 places for refugees. In the south, the city of Częstochowa said it has 1,100 places. Romania finalized an action plan on Sunday, the country's interior minister told private television station B1. We are currently analyzing how many refugee camps we can install in a relatively short time, 10, 12, 24 hours, he said. Slovakia's defense minister has said that there may be tens of thousands of refugees even under a limited conflict. He said the government was preparing for different situations with its armed forces and was in close contact with officials in Ukraine. Hungary is also making preparations. We also have a playbook and an action plan in the event of war, Hungarian Prime Minister Viktor Orban said last week. He warned of the possibility of hundreds of thousands of refugees arriving in the case of war. Think back to the 1990s, when tens of thousands of people arrived from the former Yugoslav territories. That was not easy either. But many more would come from Ukraine, probably with no hope of return, he said. Lithuania, Latvia, and Estonia have also said they were preparing to accept refugees. Lithuania's interior minister said last week that the government asked its cities and towns to list available housing. The minister added they expected refugees to come mainly from Poland and by airplane. The Baltic News Service reported earlier this week that Latvia's interior ministry is considering building refugee centers to house undocumented Ukrainian refugees. That plan would need government approval.
Thank you. man in New York State is facing a legal case that centers around his pet pig. Wyvern Flat sees Ellie the pot-bellied pig not as a farm animal, but as family. Ellie is an emotional support animal. She helped ease Flat's suffering during the end of his marriage and the death of his mother. But the village in Canajoharie, New York, where Flat lives, sees Ellie differently. Officials say she is a farm animal and, as such, is barred from living within village borders. Flat's case is the latest in a series of debates about pets in American life. The major questions are, what kinds of animals may people own? What purposes may these animals serve? Where can they be kept, and how may they be used? Emotional support animals have become common in the U.S. in recent years. The American Humane Society defines them as companion animals who help their owners deal with difficulties linked to mental health conditions. The pets provide comfort by their presence, the society says. But unlike service and therapy dogs, emotional support animals are not expected or trained to perform duties related to their owner's condition. For years, airlines were required to permit emotional support animals to fly with their owners in the passenger areas of planes. But in 2020, U.S. transportation officials said airlines could bar emotional support animals from flights. Flat was living in South Carolina when he got Ellie in 2018. She was about as big as a shoe, he said. Ellie is now about 50 kilograms. She moved north with Flat in 2019 when he bought a home in Canajoharie. In October that year, a village official visited Flat's property. The official told Flat that Ellie was legally barred from living there. 6 months later, Ellie was still there. The village began legal action. Flat was officially notified that he was in violation of a law banning farm animals in the village. I could never dream of giving away somebody who's part of my family, Flat said recently as he patted the pig in his kitchen. She's very smart. She's more intelligent than my dogs. The village's legal filing calls the pig a possible public health risk. It also argues that openly ignoring housing rules leads to a lawless community. The village also argues that it is willing to make reasonable accommodations, but that Flat never met the legal requirements. A trial was set to start on March 22nd, but it has been delayed. If found guilty, Flat could face jail time or have the pig taken from him, his lawyer says. Flat is not the first person to have issues with housing laws. In 2019, a family in Buffalo, New York, lost a case concerning their pot-bellied pig named Porkchop. The family said Porkchop was an emotional support animal for their daughter-in-law. But a court ruled that Porkchop had to live elsewhere. In Indiana, a year earlier, a woman was ordered to move her pig for similar reasons. Still, many areas around the country permit pigs as pets. Some local laws set weight limits for pet pigs. Other laws permit only pot-bellied pigs. Last month, Canajoharie approved a new, more detailed law concerning animal keeping. Farm animals are still banned from living in the village, but the new law provides clearer information on how residents can request a reasonable accommodation for emotional support animals. Flat said he has received offers from people to house Ellie outside the village, but he plans to fight to keep her. I'm John Russell. Thank you.
conservative American states are introducing more bills controlling how history and race is taught in public schools. They are also giving parents more supervision over local schools and school boards. A school board is a group of elected officials who supervise a school district's budget and educational decisions. A bill passed in Indiana that limits how race, history, and politics can be taught in the classroom. It also permits parents to bring complaints and legal action against schools. Americans are divided on how racism and discrimination in the present day should be taught. A recent study by the APM Research Lab, a policy research center, found. In a survey of 1,200 adults, 49% said schools should teach the ongoing effects of slavery and racism in the United States. But 41% say schools should teach the history of racism, but not about race relations today. Answers were also very divided by race. While 79% of black people surveyed said the ongoing effects of racism should be taught, just 41% of whites felt the same. Teaching how historical racism and slavery affects life today is a central idea in critical race theory, or CRT. Critical race theory is about how racism and white supremacy have shaped American society, laws, and policies. It has also come under attack from Republican lawmakers. In January, newly elected Virginia Governor Republican Glenn Youngkin signed an executive order banning critical race theory. Republican states, including Tennessee and Texas, passed similar laws last year. But it is unclear how many schools actually teach CRT. Critics of such laws also say that any attempt to teach racism is labeled as critical race theory. In a recent interview with The New Yorker magazine, Democratic U.S. Representative Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez said the attempts to limit how history is taught is like returning to the infamous Jim Crow era in the southern U.S. Jim Crow laws, in place for several decades until the 1960s, discriminated against black Americans in effectively all areas of life. During that time, racism and slavery was almost only taught from the white perspective, if it was taught at all. Republican lawmakers like Youngkin argue that parents and families should have more of a say in what is taught in schools, also called the curriculum. And many states have introduced bills that give parents more control over schools. APM's study found that 41% of Americans think parents should have the most influence in how race is taught to children. NBC News reports that 12 states have introduced bills that require schools to put their teaching materials online. It is part of a larger national push by Republicans for a parents' bill of rights ahead of the midterm congressional elections. Teachers say parents can already see what their children learn. They worry that the laws would create unnecessary work and could threaten their professional independence. Educators say they are not against keeping parents informed, but they see a risk that the new laws will bring censorship and more teachers leaving the profession. States considering some version of the idea include Ohio, Arizona, Florida, Georgia, Indiana, Iowa, Michigan, North Carolina, and West Virginia. Similar laws have been stopped by Democratic governors in Pennsylvania and Wisconsin. Katie Peters is a high school teacher in Toledo, Ohio. She told the Associated Press the bill suggests there's some hiding happening. She added that the parents who have cared to look have always had access. Conservative lawmakers have called for a Parents' Bill of Rights, which gives parents access to classroom materials and academic, medical, and safety records. It would also permit entry to school buildings and more. Scott DeMauro is president of Ohio's largest teachers' union. He is concerned that such bills will add to the increase in resignations and retirements that have occurred from teaching during COVID-19. Teachers, he said, have felt caught up in a culture war that they didn't create. I'm Dan Novak.
Welcome to The Making of a Nation, American History in VOA Special English. The presidential election of 1928 gave American voters a clear political choice. The Democratic Party nominated Al Smith. He was the popular governor of the state of New York. The Republican Party chose Herbert Hoover. He was an engineer and businessman who served as Secretary of Commerce for Presidents Warren Harding and Calvin Coolidge. Rich Kleinfeld and Harry Monroe tell us about the presidential election of 1928.
Governor Alfred Smith of New York had campaigned for the Democratic presidential nomination in 1924. But he was defeated at the party convention by a compromise candidate, John Davis. 4 years later, however, Smith could not be stopped. He had a strong record as governor of the nation's most heavily populated state. He campaigned for the presidency on a policy of building new electric power stations under public control. Smith knew that many conservative Americans might be worried by his new ideas and his belief in strong government. So he chose as his campaign manager a Republican industrial leader who had worked with General Motors, DuPont, and other major companies. Smith hoped this would prove his faith in the American private business system.
Al Smith was a strong political leader and an effective governor. But he frightened many Americans, especially conservative citizens living in rural areas. They lived on farms or in small towns. Al Smith was from the city, and not just from any city, but New York City, a place that seemed big and dirty and filled with foreign people and strange traditions. Al Smith's parents came from Ireland. He grew up in New York and worked as a salesman at the Fulton Fish Market. Smith was an honest man, but many rural Americans simply did not trust people from big cities. Al Smith seemed to them to represent everything that was new, different, and dangerous about American life. But being from New York City was not Al Smith's only problem. He also opposed the new national laws that made it illegal to buy or produce alcoholic drinks. And he had political ties to the New York political machine. But worst of all, in the eyes of many Americans, Al Smith was a Roman Catholic.
From George Washington through Thomas Jefferson, Abraham Lincoln, and up to Calvin Coolidge, every American president had been male, white, and a Protestant Christian. Of course, there was no law requiring a candidate to be Protestant. But millions of traditional Americans just were not ready to give their vote to a Roman Catholic. Opponents of the Smith campaign generally did not speak openly about his religion, but many of them were afraid that Smith would take his orders from the Vatican in Rome, instead of working with the Congress in Washington. Al Smith fought back. He told the country, "I am unable to understand how anything I was taught to believe as a Catholic could possibly be in conflict with what is good citizenship. My faith," he said, "is built upon the laws of God. There can be no conflict between them."
But many Protestant Americans thought there was a conflict, and they looked to the Republican Party to supply a strong candidate to oppose Smith and the Democrats. The Republicans did just that. They nominated former Secretary of Commerce Herbert Hoover, one of the country's most popular men. Hoover was well known to Americans. People trusted him, and they liked the way he had gained great personal success from poor beginnings. In fact, Hoover's life story would have pleased Abraham Lincoln, another American who rose from a poor family to fame. Hoover was born in the farm state of Iowa in 1874. His father was a poor metal worker who kept moving his family from state to state. Herbert Hoover's father died when the boy was just 6 years old. His mother died 4 years later. Young Herbert had to move to the western state of Oregon to live with his mother's brother. Herbert's uncle was luckier in life than Herbert's parents. He had made money in the land business, and he helped the boy gain admission to Stanford University in California. At the university, Herbert showed great skill in mathematics, and he decided to go into business as a geologist, studying the science of the earth.
After college, Herbert Hoover got a job as a mine worker. During the next several years, Hoover spent most of his time working as an engineer in foreign countries. And he succeeded beyond his greatest dreams. By the time he was 40 years old, he had earned more than $1 million. After World War I, he organized the effort to provide food for starving people in Europe. He did an excellent job, winning praise from people in Europe and the United States alike. Next, Hoover joined the administration of President Warren Harding, serving as the Secretary of Commerce. Again, he did a very good job. Hoover left the cabinet in 1925. But 2 years later, he organized efforts to provide relief for victims of a flood in the southern state of Mississippi. And again, Americans all around the country took note of this quiet, serious man who did such effective work in so many different kinds of situations. Some Americans, however, did not like Hoover, including some people who usually supported Republicans. For example, many professional Republican politicians did not trust him because he had spent most of his life in business, not politics. Some stock market traders thought Hoover might change the rules on the New York Stock Exchange. And many farmers believed Hoover had no new ideas about how to solve their growing economic problems.
This, then, was the choice Americans faced in 1928. On the one hand, Al Smith, a Democrat, a Roman Catholic, a politician from the city, a man wanting some social change. And on the other hand, Herbert Hoover, a Republican, a businessman who had proven the dream that even a poor boy could become great in America, a man who seemed to succeed with every effort he touched. The main issue in the campaign was not economics or religion, but the new national laws banning alcoholic drinks. Hoover was for the laws, Smith against them. The two candidates also argued about how to provide aid to struggling farmers and how to increase electricity and water supplies.
Herbert Hoover won the election of 1928. It was one of the greatest victories in presidential history. Hoover won 58% of the votes. Smith got just 40%. And Hoover captured 444 electoral votes to Smith's 87. And so it was that the engineer and businessman, Herbert Hoover, entered the White House in 1929. There was some trouble the day he moved in. Outgoing President Coolidge was a man who watched every dollar he owned. And he accused some White House workers of stealing his shoes on the day of the inauguration. But finally, safe, conservative, businesslike Herbert Hoover was leading the country.
The nation's stock market reacted by pushing stock prices to record high levels. Everyone expected that economic growth would continue and expand. But the happy times were just a dream. Within 1 year, the stock market collapsed. Millions of people lost their jobs. The nation fell into the worst economic crisis it had ever faced. Herbert Hoover was not personally responsible for the crisis. In many ways, it was his own bad luck to be elected just before the disaster struck. But it was his job to guide the nation through its troubled waters. And he would prove to be the wrong person to give such leadership. His 4 years in office would be one of the most difficult periods in the nation's history.
And that's our program for today. Listen again tomorrow to learn English through stories from around the world. I'm Jonathan Evans.
And I'm Ashley Thompson.